This episode of Remnant Radio is brought to you in part by our sponsors at Kairos Classrooms. Have you ever thought about learning a biblical language as a supplemental tool in your biblical studies? Well, Kairos Classrooms offers real classroom environments with classmates and a live instructor who can help teach you biblical languages, both Greek and Hebrew. You need to check out Kairos Classrooms today. The price for a single semester is crazy affordable for anyone, so check out the links in the description and use promo code REMNANT to get 10% off Kairos Classrooms. Check out Kairos Classrooms today. Discount code REMNANT, REMNANT, to get 10% off your semester. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the wonderful world of Remnant Radio. In this program, we've got Dr. Emerson with us, and we're going to be talking about Jesus. Did he descend into hell? How does that all make sense in the Apostles' Creed, church history, theology? What does the scripture say? It's going to be an exciting program. You guys stay tuned. You are watching The Remnant Radio, a crowd-funded show where we interview pastors, teachers, historians, and theologians from different churches and denominations. My name is Joshua Lewis, and this is my co-host, Michael Roundtree. Together, we want to help you break outside of your theological echo chambers. If you're interested in learning about history, theology, or the gifts of the Spirit, this is the show for you. Guys, thank you so much for tuning into this program. We're going to have a great discussion about the history of the Apostles' Creed, Christ ascending into hell, what the Bible says about that. Before we dive in, I want to remind you that if you want to stay up to date on all things Remnant Radio, conferences, courses, new Patreon content that we're uploading, all that exciting content can be found in the email list over at theremnantradio.com. A link of that can be found in the description of this video. Click that, subscribe to the newsletter, and you'll get all the different updates that are coming out. So the conference that we have that's going to be in Houston this fall, all of the promo codes and stuff like that would be early released to those people on the newsletter. So if you want to stay up to date all the different things that we're doing, that's the best place to check us out. Also, make sure to subscribe, like the video, all that fun stuff. Without further ado, I want to introduce you to my co-host and my guest. I've got Michael Roundtree on the line, on the left, and Matt Emerson on the right. We've got a great program for you today. Michael, tell us some, before we introduce Matt, tell us some of the good things that you've really enjoyed about the article he wrote for the Gospel Coalition. I know you and I both enjoyed that article quite a bit.
Yeah, I loved how historic it was, how scriptural it was, and I think how much it challenges the thinking of a lot of evangelicals who never really even think about this kind of thing, and I think addressed, you know, some challenging scriptures, and it was just very, very biblical, very well done, and it's an interesting question with a lot of history, and you know, you can see behind me, well, somewhere back there is Wayne Grudem's systematic theology book, and he talks about, you know, did Jesus go to hell? And Grudem comes to the conclusion that no, he did not. And I'd love to kind of explore how does Grudem arrive there, how Matt arrives, where he arrives. So definitely eager to have this discussion. So Matt, before we dive in and talk about the theological topic at hand, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about yourself. I saw there was an Auburn University diploma behind you. So I know from talking before the fan, you're a huge Cam Newton fan.
Yeah. So I'm from Huntsville, Alabama. My wife, Alicia, and I are from Huntsville, and we both went to Auburn, where I had the privilege of watching Cadillac Williams and Ronnie Brown and Jason Campbell dominate everyone. And years later, Cam Newton won us a national championship. And I can talk, we can just talk about that if you want, how Cam Newton was completely innocent and everything that happened. But I think that's not why I'm here. So after Auburn, went to Southeastern Seminary. I had felt called to ministry in high school. Went to seminary, assumed that ministry meant the pastorate in some capacity. When I finished my MDiv, I was not having much luck finding a position. And so I stayed and did a PhD. And even at the end of that process, was still thinking I was probably going to end up serving in a church somewhere. And one day, very clearly, felt the Lord calling me to academic ministry. I can get into that if you guys want at some other time, but felt a very clear call to academic ministry. And so asked the Lord, okay, if this is really the direction I'm discerning, you calling me in, I need a job at a school, which, you know, as everybody will tell you, those are difficult. And just by the Lord's providence, not by my own abilities or anything like that, ended up with a position at California Baptist University. I taught there from 2011 to 2015, and then came to Oklahoma Baptist University in 2015, and I've been there since. I've been at OBU since then. Alicia and I have five girls, and they are 15, 13, 10, and we have twin eight-year-olds. So it's been a pretty crazy time over the last decade, but we love our girls, and they bring a lot of life and joy to our house. So that's about as short as I can get it.
It's wonderful. Love that. Tell us, let's just dive into the conversation real quick about the Apostles' Creed. Talk about Christ descending into hell. It might be worthy of talking about the biblical foundation before we talk in terms of the creed and how that was one formulated. And then also this was such a key part of that creed. Maybe we can start with biblical language that talks about something that approximates Jesus ascending into hell. Where would we find verses that would suggest that in the scriptures?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a number of ways to get at that question. One way, a longer way that I'm not going to cover right now, but I'll just mention it. One way is to say, you know, hey, this is what the Bible teaches about what some people might call the afterlife, what theologians commonly refer to as the intermediate state. And so we could talk about the intermediate state and the biblical data for that, and then say, you know, according to the Bible, every human being experiences the intermediate state at death. Jesus died a truly human death, therefore he experienced the intermediate state. So that's one way to get at the question. A more direct way is to talk about some New Testament passages that say the same thing, but just sort of get directly at it without the background of what the Old Testament, for instance, says about the intermediate state. So I like to start with Matthew 12, 38 through 42. This is the sign of Jonah passage. And in that passage, Jesus says, you know, just as Jonah spent 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, so will the Son of Man spend 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And it's a very obvious, direct, clear comparison between Jesus's time in the tomb and Jonah's time in the belly of the fish. And if you go back to Jonah 2 to see how that time is described, Jonah is very clearly comparing his time in the belly of the fish, and maybe not even comparison is maybe too weak a word. Jonah is saying that his time in the belly of the fish is him in the place of the dead. And so what Jesus is doing is not just making a comparison. It's really more like this is the lesser sign in Jonah. This is the greater reality in the life of Jesus, that he actually experiences going to the place of the dead as Jonah describes being in the belly of the fish was like being in the place of the dead. So I like to start there, and then I would talk about, you know, what the place of the dead was in the Old Testament, etc. Another text in the New Testament, again, that I think very clearly talks about Jesus experiencing death is in Acts chapter 2 in Peter's speech, when Peter makes reference to Psalm 16, that you'll not abandon me to the grave, nor will you let my soul, nor will you abandon my soul into Hades. And Peter makes reference to Psalm 16, which talks about both body and soul experiencing death, as all humans do. Our body is buried or interred in some fashion, and our soul departs to the place of the dead. Ephesians 4, 8 through 10, Romans 10, 7 through 10, talk about Jesus being in the place of the dead. And then Revelation 1:18 talks about Jesus possessing the keys to death and Hades. And it's the way the verb is described is it's as if Jesus, well, it's not as if, it's describing Jesus taking the keys to death and Hades and possessing them himself. He has claimed possession from those places and now possesses them himself. And it's the idea is behind this, the way this verb is articulated by John, is that Jesus has gone to those realities and taken their keys from them. And then, of course, the most prominent passage that comes to people's minds when they think about this, and the most debated actually, is 1 Peter 3, 18 through 22. Where Peter, describing Jesus's work, talks about the crucifixion, he talks about the resurrection, but then there's this phrase in the middle where he says, you know, that Jesus by the Spirit, preached to the spirits in prison. And the question is what that's referring to. And I would say it's very clearly referring to the time between his death and resurrection and what historically has been called his descent to the dead or his descent to the to hell. Others would disagree with me on that. You already mentioned Grudem. He definitely disagrees with me on that reading of that text. But those are some of the main biblical texts that I bring up. And obviously, that's a very quick overview of those. And in order to really make a case, we need to spend some time on each of them. But just in a cursory way, those are the texts that I would start with.
Okay. Man, that's so much fun. I want to dive into all of them, but we probably won't have time for all of them. But maybe even this common thread between several of those passages is mention of Sheol or Hades, mm-hmm. or sometimes translated the grave. You've been calling it the place of the dead. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be helpful for our understanding if you could take us through your interpretation of what that place is. And how did people understand Sheol in the Old Testament? Mm-hmm. What did Jesus do markedly to kind of shift mm-hmm. things in that? So maybe you could just talk to us some about that intermediate state called Sheol.
Yeah. So I'll start with how Sheol is described in the Old Testament. And then maybe if I haven't talked too long, we can get into how Jesus affects that. But if I do talk too long, we can go to another question and deal with it. So, you know, in the Old Testament, when you talk about Sheol, Sheol is described as enemy territory, so to speak. It's the place that is not supposed to be there, but is because of sin. It's never satisfied. Everyone at death goes to Sheol. It's a common destination at death for human souls. It's an open mouth, an open grave, and once you enter in, it's inescapable. You know, so I mean, texts like Job chapter 10, Job chapter 17, Isaiah 38 talk about death, Sheol, the place of the dead, as this place where everybody goes at death and you can't get out. It's also compared to the exilic wilderness. This is sort of what Jonah's getting at in Jonah 2. It's like a desert, even though it's the bottom of the ocean. It is a place that is bereft of God's saving presence. I don't want to say that God isn't present there because God is present everywhere, but it's bereft of his presence as he's present to Israel in the temple. I'll just say it that way. But the other thing the Old Testament says about Sheol is that it's under God's authority, just like everywhere is ultimately, because he's king over all things. And so even in the Old Testament, as you get this kind of gloomy, shadowy picture of the place of the dead where everybody goes and you can't get out, there's also this language that, well, yeah, but God is also king over that place, even that place. Mm-hmm. And then you start getting language about he'll even go down there and bring light to it. And so that's part of the Old Testament hope, is that, and this is why the hope of the resurrection is a very concrete reality for Israel. In the resurrection, God will show his kingship even over the last territory of the enemy, which is death, by going down into it and bringing his people out of it. And so those are the ways that the Old Testament talks about Sheol. The other thing to say, and this really comes into play during the Second Temple period between the Old Testament and the New Testament, but there's some discussion of it even in the Old Testament as well. The Old Testament talks about the place of the dead being compartmentalized, for lack of a better word. There are the righteous dead, and then there's the unrighteous dead. And those are differentiated, even the Old Testament. The best example would be Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, where the righteous will rise to everlasting life and the wicked will rise to everlasting judgment. So there's this differentiation between the place of the dead in terms of the righteous experience and the unrighteous experience. By the time we get to the New Testament, Especially like in Luke 16, in the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, you see Jesus teaching this very clearly, that in the experience of death, there are those who are righteous. And just to be very clear by that, what I mean is, and what Jesus meant and what the whole Bible means, is those who have righteousness credited to them by faith, right? This is not righteousness from their own works. It's not righteousness based on their own moral superiority or ethnicity. It's righteousness that comes exclusively from God through faith. And so the righteous dead are in what Jesus describes as Abraham's bosom. Another way to refer to that is paradise. We might call it heaven in our language, but the biblical words for that are paradise and Abraham's bosom. And then the rich man is in Hades. We could also sometimes call that Sheol. Like, Sheol can be used negatively and not just generally. Hades can be used negatively and not just generally. And so, you know, by the time you get to the New Testament in Jesus' own teachings, you have this very clear bifurcation between compartments in the place of the dead. There's the compartment of the righteous, paradise or Abraham's bosom, and there's the compartment of the unrighteous, Hades, Sheol. And so those are the different ways in which the Bible describes the intermediate state, the state of death. And the most basic affirmation that we're talking about today is that Jesus experienced death like every human being does. His human body is buried, and his human soul departs to the place of the dead. In his case, it's to the place of the righteous dead, paradise. And this is what he says to the thief on the cross in Luke 23. Today you will be with me where? In paradise. That's a reference to the righteous place of the dead. Now, like I said a few minutes ago, Matthew 12, Acts 2, Romans 10, those all refer to Jesus going to the place of the dead. And in again, in his case, the righteous compartment of the place of the dead. What 1 Peter 3, Ephesians 4, and then just basic resurrection theology bring to the table is that Jesus didn't just go there. He went there as not just a human being, but as a human being who is also, as a person who is both human and divine, I should say. So he goes there according to his human nature, and he experiences death according to his human nature, as all humans do. His body's buried, his soul goes to the place of the dead. But he's also, at the same time, God in the flesh. And so, according to his divinity, he goes there not just vicariously to experience death with us, but he goes there victoriously as the king over all things, including over the place of the dead. Mm. While he's there, this is 1 Peter 3, he preaches the good news to the dead. That doesn't mean they get a second chance. It's not an evangelistic sermon. It's like a, hey, what's up, everybody? I win sermon. And he also, Ephesians 4 describes his resurrection and ascent as bringing the righteous dead out of the prison of death. That doesn't mean they're resurrected at that time, but it does mean that they're no longer held captive in the sense that there's no escape. Now there is an escape from death. And it's the escape that happens through faith in the Messiah, which they always have had. That's why they're in the righteous compartment. Now their faith is made sight in the descent, resurrection, and ascension. And then, as I've already mentioned in Revelation 1:18, there's also talk about him taking the keys from death and Hades. So, again, that's a really quick overview of a lot of biblical material, but that's about as short as I can get it for you.
That's wonderful. Maybe contrast that with, I mean, Michael at the top of the show said there are folks out there like Grudem who would disagree with you on your position. Now, there are people who grew up in church listening to the Apostles' Creed every Sunday. They talk about Jesus dying under the hands of Pontius Pilate, talks about Jesus ascending into hell, right? Like, there's something about descending. I say ascending is up, descending into hell, and something taking place there. So a lot of Christians have a default position. Well, of course, Jesus descended into hell. We recite that every Sunday. How do scholars such as Grudem and others like him say, well, that's what the early church thought it meant, but it actually meant something else? Like, it actually means this. Like, what's their position if you're going to try to give a charitable representation of the other side?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways that people are opposed to saying he descended to the dead, or he descended to the hell, into hell, on Sunday morning when they recite the Apostles' Creed. Grudem's position is that, first of all, 1 Peter 3 isn't talking about the time between Jesus' death and resurrection. And secondly, that the descent doctrine is that Jesus was tormented in hell. And I disagree with the first position exegetically. And, you know, if we want to talk about that, we can. But, you know, that's sort of a, you know, I don't know, inter-academic exegetical debate. It really isn't the crux of the question. On the second point, I don't think that's an accurate representation of what the descent clause has historically meant throughout church history. Up until the 20th century, when you get to Hans Urs von Balthasar, you did not have people saying that the descent clause meant that Jesus was tormented in hell. And so to reject the clause based on that kind of interpretation, I think misses how the clause was understood throughout church history, both at its origin and then in subsequent centuries. So that's one objection. In fact, Grudem has this article in JETS, the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, where at the end, and it's called He Did Not Descend into Hell, A Plea to Follow Scripture Over the Apostles' Creed. And at the end of the article, he has this long footnote where he basically says, or I can't remember, it may not be a footnote, it may be in the body, but in any case, he has this long portion of text where he says, look, if we're just saying that Jesus died and was in the intermediate state and he was victorious, then sure, I agree with that. So, I mean, Grudem actually in the end agrees, I think, with what I say the descent clause means. I just think he's misinterpreted what it meant throughout church history and rejected that misinterpretation. So that's Grudem. I think there are some other reasons that people don't like saying this. There's a historical argument that people make that they say it wasn't in the earliest versions of the Apostles' Creed, or at least it wasn't in all of them. There is a theological argument that's sort of like Grudem's, but a little bit different. Calvin, in his Institutes, when he talks about this clause, he says that the descent refers simply to the descent refers to primarily Jesus experiencing the wrath of God at the cross on Friday. So it really doesn't have anything to do with what happens on Saturday. And so rather than saying they don't say the clause, they just mean something different when they would say that clause. He really did descend into hell. He was tormented. He experienced the wrath of God on Friday on the cross. And then, along with Calvin, some other Reformed theologians during the early phases of the Reformation said it was just synonymous with he was buried. That's another way that people have rejected the clauses. They've said, well, this is just synonymous with he was buried. It doesn't mean anything else. And in fact, why do we even need it in there? And then finally, I think because of some of that confusion, right? So you've got, well, let me back up. Not finally. Then you have people who don't want to say it because it sounds too Catholic or too Eastern Orthodox. And so they're Protestants. They think that the descent clause is really more like the harrowing of hell, where Jesus either opens the way to universal salvation or opens the way to purgatory, depending on if you're Orthodox or Catholic, respectively, through his descent. And so with all of that confusion in the modern era, there are lots of Protestant churches, and especially evangelical churches, who have said, we're just not going to say that clause. We're just going to leave it out, and we don't even think it should be in there in the first place. Because that's also a part of Grudem's argument, is that it's not historically accurate to include it in the Apostles' Creed. So those are some reasons why people reject it. I try to address all those in my book. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. What's the name of your book?
It's not right next to me, it's so okay. I don't really want to get up and walk around my office. It's called He Descended to the Dead, An Evangelical Theology of Holy Saturday. And it's with IVP Academic. Actually, I think there's a, yeah, there it is. That guy right there.
There it is. All right. Awesome. Okay. Well, you know, so I want to focus on, so he descended into hell, that specific part, because typically the way evangelicals tend to think about it is that, well, technically hell, the lake of fire in the book of Revelation, is where people go after the second coming, after the great white throne and final judgment. Then people are thrown into hell, and Satan and the beast and all of that, they're thrown in. And then everybody else, death and Hades cough up the dead that are in them, and then people go to hell. So hell is future, and that there's technically no one in hell right now, but there are people in Hades, kind of like a holding cell, if you will, mm-hmm. where somebody's awaiting their sentencing trial, but they're already in a holding cell. Hades tends to be thought of that way. And yet the Apostles' Creed says Jesus descended into hell. Help us understand, in the Greek minds that were composing this creed, when they said hell, were they meaning Hades, or is there something lost in translation here? Or did some of the original creeds actually say Hades? Help us think through that.
Yeah, so I'm about to give you a bunch of Latin and German, and I'm sorry.
That's cool. We're all fluent here on the show.
Don't tempt me with a good time.
So in early medieval Latin, when the Apostles' Creed was being distributed, and obviously first versions were in Greek, which I can talk about in a minute. But in Latin, in early medieval Latin, the words inferos, which you should hear in that word, I hope I'm not going to get myself in trouble by mentioning Harry Potter, but like in Harry Potter book 6, the Inferi, the dead, rise up from the lake that Harry and Dumbledore go to. The Inferos just means dead, the place of the dead. It can, if it's a locative use of that. And then there's also in Latin the word inferna, which you should hear infernal, which is more what we would consider to be like fire or torment. But in early medieval Latin, those two terms were more synonymous than that. And they could both really refer to just the place where the dead go. And so in the early versions of the Apostles' Creed, you do find a kind of back and forth between using those two different terms. The same thing is true in German with the word hell. And I'm going to totally botch the pronunciation of this. But in German, it's H, O with an umlaut, the two dots over the O, and then L-L-E. So it's more like hull. And that just meant covered over place. Like you hear that almost the word hill in English. And it just meant covered over place. And of course, a covered over place can be a tomb, a burial site. And so in German, originally the word hell was similar to that Latin synonym situation where the word could refer, yes, to maybe torment, but more likely was a reference to the place of the dead. Eventually, and this is what happens in English, eventually that word hell just becomes torment. So people who, you know, the folks who are rejecting this just based on the idea that hell has to mean torment, that's not really what was going on in the original Latin. It's not what was going on in German, which is where we get the word hell from. It just meant place of the dead. And so when we confess that Jesus descended into hell alongside of those who wrote the Apostles' Creed, what we're confessing is, and again, along the grain of scripture, that Jesus died a truly human death, but because he wasn't just human, but was also fully divine, through entering into the place of the dead, he is victorious over it. He proclaims his victory to the dead, and then breaks down the gates on his way out.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So what word in Greek or Latin or German for that matter would we use of people who watch Harry Potter? What place of torment did they? I'm just kidding, man. You were like on a Christian podcast going, oh, am I allowed to talk about Harry Potter? This is a safe place, buddy. It's okay. I'm just joking.
We'll find out, I guess. I don't know.
That's right. We'll see. I was curious what historically Protestant, you mentioned, you know, again, older sources, Luther, Calvin, Melanchthon, who was Zwingli, like how did they interpret some of the apostolic creed language? I remember reading some biographies of Luther talking about, hey, we need to save the Roman Catholic Church. We need to reform the Roman Catholic Church. you know, creeds and I'm going to butcher this quote, you know, creeds and confessions and church dogmas, they can err, but the scriptures are inerrant. That being said, we totally think that the creeds are legit. We should hold on to them, that they are a reflection of scripture. So how do we understand the Protestant tradition and their understanding? Because you mentioned a moment ago Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy and how they've used the creeds to say maybe things that they weren't historically. How have the Protestants understood them?
Yeah. So I've mentioned most of those. So I'll try to attach some figures to that. So, you know, to begin, Roman Catholicism regarding the descent developed what we know as the doctrine of the harrowing of hell. And so Roman Catholic theology around the descent has a lot of similarities to what I'm saying in some ways. They also want to affirm that he wasn't tormented. They also want to affirm that he went to proclaim his victory. They also want to affirm that this is a release of the righteous dead from the prison of death, even if we're still awaiting the resurrection. At the same time, though, during the medieval period, their articulation of this doctrine began to be tied heavily to the development of their doctrine of the intermediate state, which, as you may know, and your hearers may know, came through as this very elaborate sense of hell, purgatory, and then the blessed state. And so, you know, you think about Dante's Inferno and Purgatorio and then Paradiso. I mean, that's what we're talking about, where there's all these levels, right? And so what Roman Catholic theology developed was this idea that in the descent, Christ opened the door from limbo to purgatory. So that everybody was actually in hell. Even if the people in limbo aren't being tormented, they're still in hell. And then at his descent, Christ opens the way from limbo into purgatory, by which souls might make their way up finally into paradise. And pause. Eastern Orthodox during the medieval period also developed a theology of the descent that, in my opinion, departed from the biblical material, but in a similar but different way. They would also affirm that in the descent, Christ is victorious. He's not experiencing torment. He's releasing captives. But in their view, because he's broken down the gates, now there's a sense in which it is possible for all men, and by that I mean humankind, to be saved. And so there's a strong sense of universalism. And I'm not calling any Eastern Orthodox theologian a universalist, but I am saying there's a strong sense of universalism in how they describe the descent. And so, well, David Bentley Hart is a universalist, but other than that, I think that what happens in the Reformation is that the reformers want to reject those unbiblical views of the descent. In doing so, they tend to end up rejecting the whole thing. And so at the Reformation, you know, you get new streams of views about the descent. The way that I've described it is the common thread. It's he experiences death like every human being does. He's victorious because he's also fully God. He proclaims his victory and he releases the captives. That's really the core of the doctrine throughout the early and medieval period. Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, that's really hard to say fast, branch off of that and develop these sub-biblical, unbiblical views. And, you know, what the reformers do, unfortunately, some of the reformers, not all of them, but what some of the reformers do is they chop off part of the root, really, in trying to chop off those unbiblical branches. Calvin is a difficult one to deal with. In the book, I just talk about his view of the descent as expressed in the Institutes, where he says the descent clause is torment on Good Friday. But he, I mean, he affirms the intermediate state. It's not like he doesn't affirm the intermediate state. That's not something I claim in the book. He affirms that. It's just when he's talking about the descent clause, he shifts directions entirely towards Good Friday rather than Holy Saturday. Martin Bucer says it's just synonymous with burial. And again, part of the motivation may be to distance reform views as far as possible from Roman Catholic views. Because if you think about the Roman Catholic view of the afterlife, which is primarily what they're responding to, when you're talking about hell and then purgatory and the different levels, now you're getting into the heart of what Luther was mad about to begin the Reformation, which is indulgences. And so, it's understandable that the Swiss reformers would want to distance themselves from any view that has to do with, the coin in the coffer springing and the soul from, or the ringing and the soul from purgatory springing, right? They want to get away from that. Luther, ironically, given his proximity to Tetzel and others teaching this about indulgences, Luther is the one who actually retains most of the historic teaching about the descent, even though it has to do with this afterlife doctrine that he's trying to teach against in terms of indulgences. He's the one who retains really the historic emphasis of the descent. He gets a little wonky because of his Christology, but if we have time to get into that later, we can. In any case, you get these different branches of the Reformation, with the descent clause just refers to Good Friday, or the descent clause simply refers to his physical burial. And that's really the streams that you would find today. You're going to find Roman Catholic views of the descent. You're going to find Eastern Orthodox views of the descent. Then you're going to find more Reformed views of the descent who follow Calvin and the Heidelberg Catechism. You'll find views of the descent that are, it's just he was buried, it's synonymous. And then you're going to find people who are just like, I don't even care. This shouldn't be here anyway.
I care. I love this. I love Jesus, like, going to death in Hades and being like, give me your keys. Love him going down and talking smack to the spirits that are now in prison. Like, I just think that's awesome.
I got
nothing to do for 3 days. I guess I'll show up on Sunday. Like, he wasn't like into this soul sleep. He was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. Like, it's an immediate thing. And so now I'm referring to 1 Peter chapter 3, that passage. Let's see if I have it right here. I do. Let me read it just for context. And actually, real quick, there was one little note I wanted to make, because some of our listeners, viewers don't know some of the terms. When we talk about intermediate state, we're talking about what happens when you die. And it's called intermediate because it's not the final state, like post-resurrection. It's before resurrection, where your immaterial spirit goes to whichever place it goes. We call that the intermediate state. So 1 Peter 3, verse 18, Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he may bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, which has to mean like something pre-resurrection, because at resurrection, he's not just made alive in spirit, he's made alive in flesh also. So, which I think is a strong argument for this is what's happening, right? Right when he dies, made alive in the spirit, which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison because they formerly didn't obey, when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, etc. Okay, so now it's just like gets weird and everybody's like, I don't know what that means. So I want to ask you what you think of Michael Heiser's interpretation. I don't know if you've heard it. I'm sure that you've heard it, whether expressed by him or somebody. But here's what Heiser says in his book Unseen Realms. He says, just like Paul portrays Jesus as a second Adam, Peter portrays Jesus as a second as another Enoch. And he points to, and he believes that's the point Peter's making here in 1 Peter chapter 3, is that just as you see in 1st Enoch, it's like chapters 6 through 15, I think, where the watchers, divine council members, where they sin, a reference back to Genesis chapter 6. And so these watchers or these sons of God, they they sin, and then God imprisons them. And that's what Heiser says is the prison that's referenced here, and this underworld prison. And then in the book of First Enoch, because Enoch never died and was just carried away to heaven, these watchers, these fallen divine and imprisoned divine council members, they appeal to Enoch. And they say, hey, Enoch, can you go talk to God for us and say, can you please let me out of here? And, you know, Enoch's like, all right. And Enoch goes on up and like, hey, God, you know, and God's like, no, they ain't getting out. And Enoch's like, sorry about you. You're not getting out. And so what Heiser says is that Peter is another Enoch, where he's going to these imprisoned watchers, these spirits now in prison, where there's a reference to the days of Noah, Genesis chapter 6, sons of God following, all of that. Just as Enoch went and told the watchers, sorry about you, you're not getting out. Jesus, in his spirit, went down into the place of the dead and talked smack to these spirits that are now imprisoned. So,
yeah.
Do you think, well, let me just ask you, do you agree with Heiser on that interpretation, or would you articulate that differently?
So there's a lot wrapped up in whether or not I agree with Heiser on that, because some of it has to do with, you know, how you understand Genesis 6, and then of course he has his own view of how Genesis 6 plays out into the rest of the Old Testament narrative, and there's a lot there to cover. And so I'm not trying to punt, but I'm going to answer your question in a different way, which is to say, I do think that Peter here is very clearly making a reference to what we would call the imprisoned evil angels in the place of the dead. So I've talked about those two compartments, the righteous and the unrighteous. The other way that the Bible talks about, and this was include Second Temple literature as well. So the Bible talks about it this way, but so does Second Temple literature, including Enoch, that there is a lower subcompartment, so to speak, of the unrighteous dead. That's the prison for evil angels. And I mean, Second Peter and Jude make reference to this as well. Peter calls it Tartarus in Second Peter. And so, yes, I do think that's who Jesus is specifically being said to speak to in this Peter passage, where Jesus is saying, I'm victorious. I win. Your rebellion is crushed. It has been crushed from the beginning, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. So it does make reference to him speaking to specifically the evil angels who are in the lower portion of the place of the dead. I think, you know, what that means is that he's speaking to all the dead as well. Imagine him standing at the top, you know, kind of with a megaphone going, what's up, y'all? I win. And, you know, for the righteous dead, that's good news. For the unrighteous dead and for the evil angels, that's terrible news, but news they already knew was coming.
So he ends his talk with boom roasted, and it has like this double purpose meaning to it. One, burn, but then also burn. Sorry, that's maybe too lighthearted. Talking about hell. Roundtree, are you cringing enough over there?
I mean, yeah, a little, just slight cringe, but it happens once or twice a show when you talk.
That's good. Okay, excellent. Praise God. You mentioned earlier keys of hell in the grave, right? These keys, you mentioned, just kind of figuratively you kind of passed over real quick. I'd be curious, could you unpack more of that to us? What would it have meant to the biblical audience having these keys? Unpack that a little bit for us.
Yeah, so I need to give a shout out to Justin Bass, who has a book called The Battle for the Keys, and it's entirely about that text, and it's awesome, and you should pick it up.
Cool.
And
it's been on our show before.
Yeah, Justin's great. He wrote the book that needed to be written to help me write the book that I wrote. He's a great scholar. And, you know, in that book, he just talks about how the key would have been representative of authority. It would have been representative of territory. And, you know, we don't really think in these terms, and, you know, it's hard for us to imagine, but what John is getting at and what Jesus is getting at as he says this, and then as John records it, is that there are really truly territories called death and Hades, and that Jesus now has the authority over both of them. And that authority means authority on who enters and exits. That's what we're talking. And, you know, this is what he says to Peter in Matthew 16. The keys of the kingdom are his, right? Whatever you bind in heaven will be loosed in heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be loosed on earth. This is authority that we're talking about. And so Jesus has the authority over these territories, these realms of death and Hades, and the keys that they formerly possessed are now his. The authority that they had, which wasn't even really theirs ultimately to begin with, he now possesses himself as Israel's Messiah raised from the dead.
Okay. All right. So I want to go to Ephesians 4, and it says, it's one of the texts that you mentioned. It says this, therefore, it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives. He gave gifts to men. So there we have the ascension. Mm-hmm. And then Paul puts almost like parenthetically, there's actual parentheses in my ESV Bible, and saying he ascended, what does it mean? Except that he also descended into the lower regions, the earth. And then there's a footnote here that says it could also mean the lower parts of the earth. So it's talking about Jesus's descent. Like, some will say he descended to the earth. Some will say he descended to the grave. Some will say he descended to the place of the dead. Help us understand how we can even go, help us understand how you think about that verse.
Yeah. So you have three options, essentially. He could be talking about descending in terms of the incarnation. He could be talking about what I think it's referring to, which is his descent to the dead, or it could be referring to his descent at Pentecost at sending the Holy Spirit. Hmm. I think that, you know, scholars have debated this for a long time. And I mean, it's not that there aren't good exegetical cases to make for the other two options, but I think that because of the Pauline cosmography, and that's, I know that's a really big nerd word, but because of the way Paul describes the map of reality in Ephesians, heaven and earth, there's these two realities, heaven and earth, right? This is bifurcation, that heaven and earth have been united in Christ. Because of the way that Paul describes the map of reality in Ephesians, because of Paul's references to the Old Testament here, because of some background information, I do think that the most likely reading is that when Paul refers to him descending to the earth, that is the lower regions, he's referring to descending to the place of the dead. So there's some important background here in Psalm 62 and Psalm 138. Really, those are Septuagint references. And in both of those cases, Paul, the psalmist makes reference to the lowest regions of the earth. And in those texts, they're referring to the underworld. So Paul's making an allusion to Psalms that are referring to the underworld when he uses this phrase, the lower regions of the earth. You also have this reality that, in Ephesians, when Paul quotes the Old Testament, he doesn't just quote these Psalms. He's also referring to some Old Testament background for the earth and the lower regions of the earth. So Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 26, Ezekiel 32, all of these seem to use that kind of phrase to refer to the place of the dead. And then there's the verb that he uses there, descended, and again, I want to refer you to Justin Bass on this stuff, but also to, I think his first name is William Bales, his work as well. Both Bass and Bales note that verb there in the Old Testament is used to refer specifically to descending into the underworld. And they both list number 16, Psalm 139, Isaiah 14. And then the last thing I'd mention there is that Frank Thielman in his New Testament theology also makes reference to the fact that there's some Greco-Roman background that is a pretty clear parallel to this phrasing to make us think that Paul is referring to not just the earth or not just Pentecost, but specifically to the underworld. So for all those reasons, you know, I think Paul is making a very clear reference to the descent. I think, you know, that that colors our understanding of he led forth a host of captives. And then he gave gifts to them.
Can you help us make sense of what's happening for people who are watching? Man, they don't, they're not super familiar with this concept, but if there was this place where in the afterlife you die, you go into this place of rest, this Abraham's bosom location, and then there seems to be like this kind of place of torment, kind of great chasm in between, if we're going to kind of build this afterlife, you know, cosmology might not be the right word, but you have this kind of the way that we're thinking of the afterlife, and Jesus descends, tells, you know, his boys in Abraham's bosom, like, hey guys, let's go, we're getting out of here, and then see you suckers to the other guys on the other side, and they kind of ascend into heaven. Like, where do we go when we die now? Do we also go to Abraham's bosom? It seems as if there's language of the dead in Christ rising first. So is there a language of like those who are kind of in the earth, they rise? Is that just a reference to their physical bodies getting caught up with their spirits? There's language of the great cloud of witnesses. So there's some folks in heaven, and it seems like people who got beheaded during tribulation are up there praying too in Revelation. So how do I make sense of all these Christians that are like dying? Do they go into Abraham's bosom? Are they present with the Lord? What's your take?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is how, I mean, to begin, we've got to be very clear that the Bible is using spatial language to describe spiritual realities. Right. So in other words, you can't get on a rocket ship and fly up to heaven, and you can't get a shovel and dig down to hell. We're talking about the Bible is using language to describe places in order to help us understand spiritual realities that we can't see, taste, touch, or feel. So when we talk about Jesus going down to paradise and then coming up and ascending into heaven, yes, that also includes the righteous dead being described formerly as being down in Sheol, but now they're described as being up in heaven because they're with the presence of the risen Christ. Their reality has changed fundamentally. Prior to his descent and resurrection and ascension, they were waiting on him. They believed in him. That's why they're there. They're there because they're righteous by faith. But he had not come yet. And so now that he's descended, risen, and ascended, their faith has been made sight, so to speak, although not in their physically resurrected bodies, but in Jesus's physical resurrected body being present with them. And so later in the New Testament, rather than Paul describing, or the other letter writers describing the righteous dead being down in Sheol, yes, we do get reference to this cloud idea in Hebrews 12, or we do get reference to the martyrs under the throne in heaven in John or in Revelation 6. We get Paul talking about being caught up to the third heaven. You know, so the New Testament shifts its spatial language to match this new spiritual reality for the righteous dead. They're no longer waiting for the Messiah. The Messiah is in their midst right now, and he has ascended into heaven. That's where he is, and so that's where they are. So, you know, I would say that it's really important to get that spatial language versus spiritual reality down as we talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me think of, I think it's 1 Samuel chapter 28, where Saul calls Samuel up through the necromancer, the witch lady, and Samuel's like, why did you bring me up from Sheol? Whereas like New Testament post-resurrection, it would be more like, why did you bring me down, right? Because anyway, to use that kind of language, I think. Feel free to correct me on that.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So I want to get practical as we want to respect your time here. So there are some viewers who are like, man, this is kind of fascinating stuff, but am I just like, I don't know, toying with intellectual things and like, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And like, does this actually affect my life? So Matt, how would you say this affects your life and Christians' lives?
Yeah. I mean, the descent is ultimately a pastoral doctrine. It's one that is intended to give us hope in the midst of really dark situations. Jesus has gone into the darkest place in existence, death, and he has there proclaimed his victory over death and come out victorious. So this, you know, really brings to life Psalm 23, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me. Well, you're with me because you've gone ahead of me. You've gone ahead of me, Jesus, and shined light in this dark place. And now there's a way out, and it's through following you. And so, you know, that's true for all of us very concretely, in that all of us either are facing death now, seeing someone we care about face death now, or we know eventually we will face death in our future. And so for death to be a pervasive reality, but to know that Jesus is king, even over that place, even over that reality, is a great comfort, that Jesus has experienced death with us and for us, and that through experiencing death, he has conquered death, and now we don't have to fear it. Obviously, all of this is rooted ultimately in the resurrection, so the descent doesn't stand by itself as a doctrine. It's reliant both on Jesus' death on the cross, because in there he paid the penalty for sin that allows him to be victorious over death, and in the resurrection he rises from the dead, which allows him to proclaim his victory over death, even if it is sort of a, you know, this is about to happen, but I'm still winning, right? I've already won through the cross, right? The descent is reliant on Good Friday and Easter Sunday, but that doesn't make it any less important. It really is a way for us to articulate that there's hope even in the darkest moments of our lives, because Christ has already gone into that dark place, and he has already experienced it with us and also for us. So it's really a pastoral doctrine. It's also an important doctrine for orthodoxy. The descent clause, and we didn't have time to get into this, but the reason why the descent clause kind of comes in and out of the Apostles' Creed is because it was during the times that the church was combating Apollinarianism in particular that the descent clause was so important. People in the early church would have understood he was buried. He was dead and buried as his body was buried, his human soul departed to the place of the dead. But when you get to the heresy of Apollinarianism, excuse me, that's a denial that Christ had a human soul. And so what better doctrine to combat the heresy of Apollinarianism, excuse me, than one that affirms Christ's human soul?
That's wonderful. Hey, like I said, we want to make sure that we get you out on time. I know you got a busy schedule. So I want to thank Dr. Emerson for coming on the program. For those of you who want to get familiar with his material, we can link up that kind of stuff in the show notes. We're also working on the website. Website will be hopefully relaunched in the next week or two, and that will include recommended reading resources for people who are like, hey, we want to check out all of the different podcasts. And, you know, you've listened to a podcast, you want to check out the book, we'll have that listed there on the website. So one-stop shop for you, for everyone who wants to be interested in that kind of thing. Thank you, Dr. Emerson, for coming on the program. And for the rest of you who are watching, you know, stay tuned, subscribe to the newsletter so that you're updated when we come out with new content on Patreon, conferences, courses, all that good stuff. Subscribe to the channel, like the video as we keep coming out with other content just like this. We'll see you guys next Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. We're talking about ayahuasca. That'll be fun. Want to thank Kairos Classrooms for sponsoring this episode of Remnant Radio. And if you're out there, you've ever wondered, hey, I wonder if learning a biblical language would be a supplemental tool for me to help me in my biblical studies. Well, you need to check out Kairos Classrooms. They offer Greek and Hebrew classes that can help teach you and train you. It's a live classroom environment with actual students and actual live teachers, and they help teach you the biblical languages of Greek and Hebrew. And you need to check out Kairos Classrooms today. There's a link in the description, and you can use the promo code REMNANT to get 10% off.
These classes are already crazy affordable, but with the promo code REMNANT, REMNANT, you'll get 10% off of Kairos Classroom. So check that out today. And thank you so much for Kairos for sponsoring this episode of Remnant Radio.